Men always think that they can improve on God's ways. They think, oh, well, we've got technology now that will just, you know, with AI, we can figure out anything. But did you know that AI is dependent upon the information that's put into it? And you know, we have an old saying, garbage in, garbage out. Well, that's what you get. Same frailties, only they can do it a lot faster. But anyway, our reading tells us that God's thoughts are not our thoughts, and His ways are not our ways. And notice that He says, as the rain comes down, the snow waters the earth and makes it bring forth and bud, He said, so shall my word be that goes forth from my mouth. It shall not return to me void, but it shall accomplish what I please and shall prosper in the thing for which I sent it. But Paul wrote in 1 Corinthians, and I'm going to try to get caught up with my, oh, well now, tonight, I haven't got it all put together yet. There we go. Yeah. 1 Corinthians chapter 1, verses 18-29. Notice that Paul says, the message of the cross is foolishness to those who are perishing, but to us who are being saved, it is the power of God. For it is written, I will destroy the wisdom of the wise and bring to nothing the understanding of the prudent. Where is the wise? Where is the scribe? Where is the disputer of this age? Has God not made foolish the wisdom of this world? For since in the wisdom of God, the world through wisdom did not know God, it pleased God through the foolishness of the message preached to save those who believe. Jews request a sign. Greeks seek after wisdom. But we preach Christ crucified. To the Jews, a stumbling block. To the Greeks, foolishness. But to those who are called, both Jews and Greeks, Christ, the power of God and the wisdom of God. Because the foolishness of God is wiser than men, and the weakness of God is stronger than men. For you see your calling, brethren, not many wise according to the flesh, not many mighty and not many noble are called. But God has chosen the foolish things of the world to put to shame the things which are mighty, and the base things of the world to bring to nothing the things that are, that no flesh should glory in His presence. Since God's ways are obviously not man's ways, let's consider together God's ways versus man's ways. For instance, when it came to taking a city, God gave orders to Israel in Joshua chapter 6, verses 2-5. He said to them, see, I have given Jericho into your hand. Its king, the mighty men of valor, you shall march around the city. All you men of war, you shall go around the city once. And this you shall do for 6 days. 7 priests shall bear 7 trumpets of ram's horns before the ark. But the 7th day, you shall march around the city 7 times, and the priests shall blow the trumpets. Then it shall come to pass, when they make a long blast with the ram's horn, and when you hear the sound of the trumpet, that all the people shall shout with a great shout, then the wall of the city will fall flat down. And the people shall go up, every man straight before him. Now that was God's way of taking a city. That was God's way. God didn't fool around with this building rampart. He said, nope, you do it this way. Oh, so man comes along and says, well, but, you know, walking around that city and all those footsteps walking around there, that made the land shake. And it made the ground unstable. And then whenever they did it seven times on the seventh day, that shook it loose. And when they yelled, that's when it all came apart. No miracle, see. But they have a problem with God saying the wall of the city will fall flat down. Now, what did he mean by that? Well, and what they've been able to find, the leftover remnants, let's put it that way, of the city of Jericho, evidence is that the city wall went straight down. It didn't fall out on the people, didn't fall in on the people. It went straight down. And that wasn't any man-made occasion. In 2 Kings chapter 19, verses 35 and 36, in man's ways of doing these things, Sennacherib, king of Asia, brought 5,180 men to conquer Israel. He was counting solely on the strength of numbers. But our text says, it came to pass on a certain night, the angel of the Lord went out and killed in the camp of the Assyrians 185,000. And when the people arose in the morning, there were corpses, all of the dead. So Sennacherib, king of Assyria, departed, went away, returned home, and remained at Nineveh. Now you remember, Nineveh was a city that you hear about several times. But boy, he got what was coming to him. He got what was coming to him. Also, whenever it came to ruling a nation, God had appointed judges to rule over the people, but the people weren't satisfied. They weren't satisfied. What do we read in 1 Samuel 8, verse 4 and 5? Well, all the elders of Israel gathered together, and it came to Samuel, who was a prophet, at Ramah. And they said to him, look, you're old, and your sons don't walk in your ways. Now make for us a king to judge us like all the nations. Man's way said, oh, give us a king. Give us a king. And notice the reason for this. That we might be like the nations around us. Being like the nations around them was not necessarily a good thing. Rolling on down in verses 6 and 7. We read, the thing displeased Samuel when they said, give us a king to judge us. Well, why did it displease Samuel? Well, Samuel took it as a personal offense. God had given him the responsibility for judging the people. And unfortunately, they reject, and so they were rejecting Samuel, really, is what he thought. And Samuel prayed to the Lord, and the Lord said, Samuel, heed the voice of the people and all that they say to you, for they have not rejected you, but they have rejected me, that I should reign over them. What happened? God was the one who reigned over them as king. Samuel merely acted as a judge. And they had rejected God. They said, we don't like it the way it is. We want to be like the nations around us. And in their nearsightedness, they thought they were only rejecting Samuel. They didn't realize the consequences of rejecting God as their king. But the ways of God and the ways of men are quite different when it came to utterly destroying a city and its contents. We read in 1 Samuel 15, verses 2 and 3, the Lord says, I will punish what Amalek did to Israel, how he laid wait for him on the way when he came up from Egypt. Now go and attack Amalek and utterly destroy all that they have. Do not spare them. Kill both man and woman, infant and nursing child, ox, sheep, camel, donkey. This is what God commanded this king that they had over them to do. Utterly destroy the Amalekites. Not to leave one living creature. But Saul had a better idea. Back to 1 Samuel 15, beginning verse 13 down through 15. Samuel went to Saul, and Saul said to him, blessed are you of the Lord. I have performed the commandment of the Lord. And Samuel said, what then is this bleating of the sheep in my ears and lowing of the oxen which I hear? Now notice how Saul shifts the blame. They have brought them from the Amalekites. The people spared the best of the sheep and oxen to sacrifice to the Lord your God. Notice how he removed himself. Yeah. And the rest we have utterly destroyed. Well, that wasn't true. That wasn't true. Look down at verse 22. And what do you find in verse 22? Has the Lord as great a delight in burnt offerings and sacrifices as in obeying the voice of the Lord? That was the issue. God's way was the right way. He said, utterly destroy. And Saul just thought, well, we'll bring home the best of the sheep and the oxen. And by the way, we're going to bring Amalek too. You had such a thing against Amalek. We're going to bring him so we can kill him here right in front of you, okay? Behold, to obey is better than sacrifice, and to heed than the fat of rams. No amount of rationalization will come up with a better way. No amount. But we have another example. Defeating the giant. God's way versus man's way was somewhat different. If you turn over to 1 Samuel 17, and look at verse 41. Now the Philistine came and began drawing near to David. And the man who went before the shield went before him. Then verse 43. So the Philistine said to David, "Am I a dog that you come to me with sticks?" And the Philistine cursed David by his gods. And the Philistine said to David, "Come to me and I will give your flesh to the birds of the air and the beasts of the field." Goliath had intimidated the entire army of Israel by his mere brute strength. And they were convinced beyond a reasonable doubt that no one could defeat him. In fact, Goliath figured on overpowering David as well. But here's where we come to the difference between man's way and God's way. God had a different way of defeating the giant. Notice in 17 and verse 40, "Then David took his staff in his hand. He chose for himself five smooth stones from the brook, put them in a shepherd's bag, in a pouch which he had, and his sling was in his hand, and he drew near to the Philistine." Now, everybody pretty much figured that David was taking on more than he could handle. But look at what David says to him. The Philistine looked down, saw David, disdained him, for he was but a ruddy youth. And then down verse 45, David said to the Philistine, "You come to me with a sword and a spear and a javelin, and I come to you," listen, "I come to you in the name of the Lord of hosts, the God of the armies of Israel, whom you have defied." That's it. And listen, and now this, of course, this sounded pretty strong, but listen to what he proclaims. "This day the Lord will deliver you into my hand, and I will strike you and take your head from you. And this day I will give the carcasses of the camp of the Philistines to the birds of the air." Now, oh, wow, birds of the air and the wild beasts. "That the earth may know there is a God in Israel." Now, just a minute now. David, you're going to do all this? And then you're going to say, now you've seen there is a God in Israel. Aren't you doing this for your own benefit? Not at all. David said, "When I do this, this assembly will know that the Lord does not save with sword and spear." Listen to this. "For the battle is the Lord's, and he will give you into our hands." Wow. David called on the name of Jehovah God and knew that he would conquer the giant. And by using God's way, that's exactly what he did. That is exactly what he did. But men haven't changed over the stream of time. I tell you, years go by and circumstances change, and men still try to substitute their ideas for God's commands. For instance, when it comes to salvation, men say, you can be saved by faith only. Or you can pray through for salvation. Now, these change through the years, and some make them more inclusive and some less inclusive. But basically, you have the same thing. Merely believing on Christ, and that constitutes salvation. Or seeking Christ through prayer. And once you get something that feels like the Holy Spirit, and you don't know what it is you're supposed to feel like, but you get something that when you get it, you know. Anyway, and that's how you... But what's God's way? What's God's way? Well, God's way is pretty simple, really. If you look at Mark 16 and verse 16, he who believes and is baptized will be saved. Now, if you were to write this down in an equation, you'd say belief plus baptism equals salvation. I don't know what's complicated about that. That's about as simple as it can be. But man's way keeps coming back, say, oh, no, no, no. You've got to be saved by faith only. Well, isn't that strange? Because the only place that I find the word faith and only connected in the entire Bible is James 2:24. And you know what James 2:24 says? You see then that a man is justified by works and not by faith only. That's right. The only place faith and only are together, they are preceded by not by faith only. So, big difference between man's way and God's way. But same thing applies to the church. Men say, there's many churches. And you can choose the one you like. But God's way says, well, Jesus said in Matthew 16, verse 18, upon this rock I will build my church. Now, without getting into what the rock is, simply, he's going to build his church. Or churches? No, his church. And the gates of Hades shall not prevail against it. Which means simply, death will not keep him from building it. And Jesus was speaking here of one church. And whose church is it? Well, it's his. It's his. Now, in Ephesians chapter 4 and verse 4, we read, there is one body and one spirit, just as you were called in one hope of your calling. Now, stop right there. One body. What's the body? Well, Ephesians 1, 22 and 23, Paul told us that God, Christ, our God, put all things under Christ's feet and gave him to be head over all things to the church, get this, which is his body, the fullness of him who fills all in all. He gave Christ to be head of the church, not churches. And notice the church is the body. The body is the church. Christ is the head. And there is one body. As surely as there is one Spirit. And one hope of your calling. And one God and Father of all who is over all, through all, and in y'all. If we choose the church of our choice, it's no guarantee that Christ is the head of it. No guarantee, because he only built one, and he's only the head of one. But here again, we see man's actions in regard to the organization of the church. Men today say, well, you got to have a pope. He's got to have somebody to run the church. Well, where do you read about this? Well, it's in some man-made books long after the last apostle's dead. No, I don't think so. Or, well, you have to have conventions. That way you're sure that everybody's on the same page. Or you have to have world councils, and there has to be a president of it. But at the very least, you have to have a board of deacons who can tell the preacher what to do. Which is interesting, because that doesn't fit with the work that deacons do. None of these are found in God's way. As we just saw in Ephesians chapter 1, 22 and 23, Christ is the head of his body, the church. And we find that there are to be elders in every church who are charged with the oversight of that local church. Paul mentioned local elders in Acts 14, 23, but also in Philippians 1, verse 1. That was in our daily Bible reading. Philippians 1, verse 1. Whenever he addresses his letter to the Philippians, he says, Paul and Timothy, servants of Jesus Christ, to all the saints in Christ Jesus at Philippi, with the bishops and the deacons. There's your elders and deacons right there. That's God's way of doing things. Far cry from what man comes up with. But man's ways are also seen in the way that worship is engaged in various churches today. Men say, oh, it doesn't matter. You can use mechanical instruments of music, or you can have a play or a pageant or count beads or burn candles, all this kind of, and that's acceptable worship. But God's way is very simple. God says that the hour is coming, and now is, when true worshipers will worship the Father in spirit and truth. For the Father is seeking such to worship him. God is spirit, and those who worship him must worship in spirit and in truth. Our worship must be in accord with God's revealed will. Any worship which varies from the prescribed order is therefore sinful. In Acts 2, verse 42, we find that the early church, under the guidance of the apostles, continued steadfastly in the apostles' doctrine, the teaching, fellowship, the breaking of bread, and in prayers. In Colossians 3 and verse 16, Paul told the members of the church in Colossae, let the word of Christ dwell in you richly in all wisdom, teaching and admonishing one another in psalms, hymns and spiritual songs, singing with grace in your hearts to the Lord. You notice all reference to the music used by the early church just says they sang. Not one mention is made of playing on any mechanical instrument. Now, let me make this clear. It's not a matter of the Lord's church being so poor it can't afford one. Because people had stringed instruments back in their day or in the first century and could easily use them to play along with their, but they didn't do it. And no matter how good we, man's way, we think it may sound, we must do things in God's way. We need to remember all of what we've studied today. If you go ahead and do what seems right to you, you can't all of a sudden tell God, oh, I thought this was a good idea. I thought surely you would accept this. No, it won't work. It won't work. But another area where we see man's ways replacing God's ways is in the work of the church. Man says that the work of the church primarily is social. So, following that idea, they include social activities. They include entertainment. They include amusement for the kiddies. And they entice the adults, the grown-ups, with recreational activities. I was thinking about family that used to worship up with us, and that's what they went to. They went to a church that had a baseball team. That's what they wanted, I guess. But that's not that what we read about in the scriptures, is it? God has revealed the work of the local church. And doing it man's way has, at the end of it, eternal destruction. That's right. We find that the church is engaged in proclaiming the gospel of Jesus Christ, taking care of needy saints, and doing the work of worship and service to God. Finally, in the area of responsibility, we see many today trying to throw off their responsibilities. Men say, oh, put them on someone else. Or put them on the church. So what they will do is they will brag about what they have done. Oh, well, look what we've done. When in reality, what was done looked big, but whenever you divide it down to the members, it doesn't come out to very much. Maybe $5 a head. But it looked big whenever we put it, wow, we made this contribution. No, that wasn't the church working. That's not the work of the church. Paul tells us in Galatians chapter 6, and verse 10. That individually, now this is individual, as we have opportunity, let us do good to all, especially those who are of the household of faith. Can you imagine what would have happened to the Good Samaritan if one of our modern thinking brethren would have been there to advise him? Surely they would have formed a beaten by robbers relief society. And they would have been out getting all the money. And pretty soon they would say, you know, we need a sponsoring church who can oversee this relief effort. So they gather up a sponsoring church. But did you notice the Samaritan took care of it himself? Not only was he at a disadvantage being a Samaritan, but he was doing it for someone who basically looked at him as a dog. Yeah. Yet he did it. He did it. In James chapter 1, verse 26 and 27, James says, if anyone among you thinks he is religious and does not bridle his tongue but deceives his own heart, this one's religion is worthless. Pure, undefiled religion before God the Father is this: to visit orphans and widows in their trouble, and to keep oneself unspotted from the world. This is to you and to me. This is to us as individuals. We have to bear that responsibility. We dare not try to substitute our way for God's way. Remember what the wise man of old said in Proverbs 14 and verse 12? There's a way that seems right unto a man, but its end is the way of death. Man's way looks good. Man's way seems to really accomplish it, but it's not God's way. We're interested in God's way. And may God give us the strength and ability to always do things His way. No matter how much we're tempted to do it another way, do it God's way. It will always be blessed.